Tuning in to Doth Protest, and we have Kyle Tomlin back with us, as well as James Rickenbacker, and this is Drew, and this is, of course, as you'll be listening to this, if you listen to it when it first comes out, it'll be Reformation Day, or the day before, if I decide to publish it then, which I may, or whenever you're listening to this. This is a reformationally themed episode, but this is also a reformationally themed podcast, so that shouldn't be a surprise. But today we're going to look at, we're going to go around and compare and contrast the two main movies made about Martin Luther. There has not been a whole lot out there brought attention besides one study, which I'll get into later, which I did discover. But Luther has been in a lot of films, a lot of movies. More so than like any other figure of the Reformation. And of course his story definitely lends itself to that. So we're just gonna discuss the two main movies. That one was made in 1953, one was made in 2003. And James, Kyle, and I are gonna talk about which of those two we prefer, but you know, things we may have liked about both of them or each one of them. And then through some internet research I've done recently, I've discovered there's been lots of movies made about Martin Luther, and I've actually did see one of the lesser known ones, which I'll get into later. But I'll just kind of go through the list of ones I've discovered, but we'll do that later on. And there's also been a lot of documentaries, but we're not gonna talk about those just because we'd be here for like hours, because that's also just a whole list, because it seems like every several years there is one, especially if there's like a Reformation anniversary and whatnot. And so documentaries won't be on the table today. We're not discussing those. So James and Kyle, how are y'all doing?
I'm doing well. Life is busy. October has been exceedingly busy. I'm glad to see the end of October for many reasons. Probably chief among them is we get to celebrate the Reformation tomorrow, or as people have been carping online, the Reformation didn't start in 1517. Although the date that folks tend to trot out is June 25th, which that's the signing of the Augsburg Confession in 1530, which the Reformation was, you know, already very clearly established by then. So I'm going to stick with October 31st.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for having me back on the podcast. Great to be with you guys. And I kind of echo James's situation. Just been a busy fall, but I'm happy for the end of October as well. Always love Reformation Day, and always love forward to some candy tomorrow.
You cut out a second there. What was it about passing? Was it candy or passing out? Were you talking about?
Oh, I said I'm always looking forward to eating some candy and tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Well, we did a trunk or treat at the church yesterday, which we had a real good turnout for, and it was really cool to see and fun. And I still have lots of candy, so I suppose. And I'm just not a big sweet tooth. My wife is, but she's not going to eat all that. And so I have a feeling we'll be passing out candy tomorrow too. And then when it's gone, shop's closed, we're turning the porch lights off. But from what I hear, this will be the first Halloween that we're in this house. We're in this neighborhood. And I guess there, from what I've heard, there's lots of kids that come in our neighborhood. So, but yes, of course, the greater day over Halloween is Reformation Day tomorrow. And, you know, in Episcopal churches, I don't know if it is Reformation Day a deal at all in any of the, so it's even with such a with such reformational heritage as the Anglican tradition has, I think it's kind of, we don't really have a Reformation Day so much like perhaps the Lutheran Church and perhaps some other reformational churches, but outside of commemorative feasts for reformers like Cranmer and Ridley and whatnot. But so you both actually just watched and James, you said you watched for the first time both the 1953 and 2003 film versions, which surprised me, actually. I had figured for sure you would have seen one of them, but what was your...
I didn't even know the 1953 one existed before we talked about doing this episode. I knew about... We already owned the 2003 one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, it actually... Not only was it put together by the Lutheran Church, but it also actually received like Oscar nominations and stuff.
It did. It got two Oscar nominations. I don't know if it won those, but I had it in my notes. I think it was, yeah, cinematography and art direction, which I could definitely see. It's a black and white film, 1953. And which of the two, James, did you like the most and why? Of the, because you saw both of them very recently, like in the past several days, and they were
in the past 24 hours.
The past 24 hours.
Yeah, I went ahead and binged both of them. Today's my day off, so it works out well.
Which is funny because sometimes on days off, I don't like to even do church related, like whether it's books or I'll watch or read something totally different. I'm kind of breaking my own rule with, hey, this is Monday's my day off too, and we're doing a religious podcast. But anyways, I'm sorry.
I mean, I enjoyed it. I started the day by reading Calvin's Institutes and Scripture, and then moved on to the two movies about Luther. So
yeah.
So I'm a bit of a nerd in that way, I guess, and that's perfectly okay. But I would say that of the two, I really liked them both.
Mm-hmm.
But I preferred the Josephine's 2003.
Okay.
And I know that Drew, you and I disagree about this because we've talked about it before. To quote a famous person, "Here I stand, I can do no other."
You feel that strongly about it, okay?
Well, I say that.
I like them both, by the way. But yes, revealed what all. Yeah, but. My favorite one is the 50.
Oh, see, you got to cut that out of the episode so that they don't get a sense before you do the big reveal.
I'm not sure. It's not a big reveal. Yeah. But yeah, what?
So what I will say is this. I feel like the character development in the 2003 version was better. I felt like especially two very, very important people in the life of Martin Luther were portrayed in a more sympathetic, more helpful fashion in the 2003 movie. And that's von Staupitz and Katharina von Bora. I felt like both of them were done a great service in the second movie, the 2003 movie, because of how well they portrayed. I thought Josephine's did a very good job as Luther, someone who had the courage of his convictions. Part of my sort of trying to figure out which one I thought was better also has to do with the fact that, you know, when I was watching the 1953 one, it is very 1950s in the style of acting. And so what was, you know, traditional and well done in the 50s might be considered to a certain extent just a tiny bit of overacting today. So like when Niall, I don't remember what his last name is, the guy that played Luther,
McGinnis,
something like that. Irish
guy playing Luther.
Right,
Joseph Fiennes is he's British, so I mean
he's British, yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, any good guys in film are always portrayed by the Brits, right? But
unless it's Star Wars, then it's all the villains.
That's true. Very, very, very well said. Very well said. At the Diet of Worms, where where Luther is standing up and giving his famous speech that he probably didn't give. Here I stand, I can do no other, but you get the point. You know, when he says, my conscience is captive to the word of God, which of course Luther did say, he's shaking and you can almost see his jowls, you know, moving because of how intensely he was trying to portray Luther. And that kind of transported me out of it a little bit, to be completely honest. But I thought that overall, both of them were very, very well done. And I'm being a bit pedantic to even go that far. But yeah,
no, so I would say that's a good analysis. I wouldn't say it's pedantic. I actually had a similar, but ultimately differing, because that made an impression on me too, that scene at Worms in the 53. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But I'm sorry, go, what were you?
Well, I was pretty much done. I felt like both were very well done. Both were very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Both made me want to go read The Bondage of the Will and things like that again. Oh, I did like the portrayal in the 53 of Erasmus. The fact that he was there in that one was good. And he was not present in the 2003, but the 53, I think, took less dramatic license and tried its best to stick to the historical words of Luther, which was, I thought, fantastic. But because of that, it was a little harder to see some of the character development, because when Luther is recounting all of the things that he said, he wasn't, you know, recounting the love story with Katharina von Bora, or even to any real extent, the level of influence that von Staupitz had mm-hmm. in his life. I mean, of course, you can see it in Luther's writings, but it's not quite to the level as portrayed in the 2003. But the fact that it was, you know, sponsored by and produced by the Lutheran Church, I thought was really cool, and I thought that was certainly why it was so faithful to the historical narrative.
Yeah, the attention it paid to the 53 version, that it paid to the historical detail, as well as I thought got more of the theological, what was at stake theologically, was more mm-hmm. dealt with. And I think in a less post-Christendom age is when maybe the Fiennes film was made. I think that's that attention to history and theology in the 53 one is, I think, is due, and this is one of the reasons I find it preferable to the other, to Theodore Tappert and Yaroslav Pelikan were consultants for the movie. So
yeah. Cool. Yeah, I noticed that as well in the credits in the beginning.
Yeah, that's very cool. And that certainly would explain why it was very faithful.
Yeah. And of course, that was at the height of translating Luther's works into English for the first mm-hmm. time. So it's kind of a, I don't know, say a time capsule, but the movie kind of comes from that era of kind of a post-war. I mean, the churches are growing across the United States. There's this kind of interest in the Christian faith, Christian figures portrayed in film, especially epic films. Not that the Luther movie of 53 was an epic film, but you saw a whole bunch in the 50s after like several decades of not seeing that too. Just kind of a side note, how we can kind of fit that 50s version of Luther into broader cinematic film history. It's kind of an interesting point, but yeah, I think I do like the attention, going back to my main point, I do like the attention it gives to the history and theology. It did have historical inaccuracies, the 53, just as the 2003 one did. Sure. I think if you go to the wiki page for each film, they have a whole section on historical inaccuracies. For both films, I think the inaccuracies were so, I don't know, minor. They didn't, they weren't egregious or anything. I mean, it was right. Just kind of, this person actually didn't meet him until 1526 versus 1523, something minute, like minor like that. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like an example was Spalatin. There's no indication when Luther met Spalatin, but both movies said that they met in law school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the case.
Well, at least I mean, maybe it was the case, but I don't think there's good evidence to say where they met. They just became friends, and Spalatin, of course, became an important performer with Luther.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of where both of you guys are. I think that both of the movies were great. I hadn't seen the Joseph Fiennes one probably for about 15 years or so. So it was like a brand new movie watching it over again. And I had actually never seen the 1950s one. So that was completely new for me. And I'm split down the middle with the two of them. I think that there were really strong things about both of them. And then there were things that I saw a lot of artistic license in what they were doing, and that put me off a little bit on some of them. But I probably would give the slight edge to the 1950s one, just because it was trying very hard to sort of stick to the theological aspect of it. But that said, and James is shaking his head no in disagreement with me.
For shame, for shame. You're supposed to be the tiebreaker.
Sorry. Well, I guess I did break the tie.
Yeah, right. He's doing exactly what you wanted him to do.
That's right. So, I do give it a slight edge. I think that I appreciated the fact that they were very much trying to adhere to the theology and use as much of Luther's direct material in the film, whereas they took a lot of license with the later one. Although they did it in creative ways in the later one, the scene where the young man commits suicide in the Joseph Fiennes version, the 2003 one. And then Luther comes down and gives a whole big speech about how those who commit suicide are not damned by God, and buries him and gives him the absolution when he buries him, which is a very powerful scene, right? Mm-hmm. A very strong thing. I thought to myself, that sounds vaguely familiar, but I don't really remember Luther doing that. And then it occurred to me that where that actually comes from is Luther's letters of spiritual counsel. Hmm. So in Luther's letters of spiritual counsel, he addresses the issue of suicide, consoling someone who had lost a loved one in suicide. So I think they were playing with that idea and just creating a scene to sort of drag that in, because you can't just have Luther read a letter that he's written to somebody. Mm-hmm. So there's some creative stuff there that I think was good, that did try to capture very much Luther's theology. I did appreciate, going back to what you're talking about with that scene at Worms, with the, in the 1950s movie, he looks like he's about to burst the blood vessel. He's getting so tense over that moment.
Right.
And there is something powerful to doing it in that way, right? I can see where that can be very touching. Although I think from what I've read of Luther, that when he was questioned there, he actually approached it more like the Joseph Fiennes way, mm-hmm. that he was, I seem to remember reading the detail that people found him inaudible when he was there, that he was actually, on the quieter side of speaking. And then that was captured very well with the Joseph Fiennes one. So, yeah, I split down the middle with it.
Where did you read? I'm just curious about the source of them. Obviously, it had been like a witness or someone who talked secondhandedly, perhaps, to someone who was present. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, that's always a good question, because I read.
I'm not trying to
remember where I read.
Yeah, I'm not trying to challenge you. I'm generally genuinely curious, because I'd never come across that, but I'm curious.
You know where it might have been? So it could have been in the Heiko Obermann book, Luther, Man Between God and the Devil. It could have been in there. And then Well, it could also have been in Jim Nestegan's short bio of Luther. That might have been one source where I read it.
Which I still need to read. I think you brought that short book up way back when we did the Jim Nestegan episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was the Martin Luther A Life. That might have been the one. Yeah. So one of those two ones seems to, if I'm digging back in my brain, one of those two ones might have been where I actually heard that before. But
Kyle, you spoke a moment ago about Luther's letters of spiritual counsel. And I remember reading a quote from Luther, and I don't know if it was from, because he may have addressed suicide more than once, but from wherever.
He did it in the table talks too.
In the table. So it was either letters of spiritual counsel or table talks, where he described what happens at suicide is when the person takes their life, what they're doing is it's completely, Luther described it as the devil's taking their hands and doing that it's not that person's will to do that they're
right.
They've been overcome, and it's terrible and it's tragic, but he's trying to show how you know, the devil had the power in that situation. It was not that person's, I don't want to say it's not that person's fault, but you know what I mean. It was a try, rather than an immediate judgment or condemnation, he tried to see how that person was so lost in the grief or whatever it was that was just tormenting them and weighing on them, that he attributed it not to the person but to evil and so on, to the devil. And so always found that is a very consoling thing to. It's a very tough subject. I didn't think we'd be veering down this road in this episode, but it is in that movie, and I think that was perhaps the 2003 movie where the young boy killed himself, and Luther, you know, gives him a proper burial. And I think that was probably, you know, them taking, yeah, like you said, taking creative license to show Luther's how he pastorally dealt with suicide in a very good way, rather than just filming him write a letter to someone. It's hard.
Yeah. Like,
there's not many movies made of theologians, because most theologians just sit down and think and write.
Right.
Exciting. Right. So many theologians' works are. I mean, you know, a lot of them you couldn't really do movies on. I mean, C.S. Lewis, there's been movies made about him, but you know, there's not a lot of theologians where they, certainly no reformers outside of
right.
I mean, maybe Cranmer, that would be, I mean, there's been lots of things about the shows and movies on the Tudors, and Cranmer appears in a lot of them. So that would maybe be up there too, as far as an exciting, engaging show or movie. But most of the reformers and a lot of theologians, yeah, it's kind of just, you know, it's their thinking and writing, and it's just how it is.
Yeah. By the way, in Martin Luther A Life, the Gymnastigan book, he says about at the Deed of Worms, he says, "So he spoke softly but confidently, so quietly that some had difficulty hearing him, indicating that yes, the books were his, but that God's word was at stake here, and he needed some time to consider."
Oh, thank you. Brain, you didn't fail me.
And what's his footnote for that?
he doesn't footnote it, but Kyle footnoted it by mentioning the book. So we'll go.
Were you there? I'm just kidding.
Well, but you also have to realize that in Jim's book, he's got pictures from the 2003 movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
Well.
Yeah.
What I would have liked, I'll put it this way, about the 2003 version is how the 2003 version, well, Fiennes and McGinnis give two very different portrayals, but I think they both, I think, genuinely were striving to be accurate in how they portrayed this man lived and they were both trying to get Luther right and to be true and faithful to who Luther was. And I noticed in the Fiennes portrayal, like the 2003 version explored Luther's anxieties and fears, I think, more, but I just didn't know how, I didn't think it was ultimately executed that well. I mean, for me speaking, because when I watched, like, there's a couple scenes where this 2003 version, there's a couple scenes where Joseph Fiennes or Luther, he's in his he's in his cell, like his monastic cell or his room, and he's having like spiritual torment. He's having these sessions of fighting with the devil, and he's having these verbal outbursts. He's yelling at something else, or like there's something else there in the room. And it just wasn't, I remember like I showed this movie one time to some ninth grade level. They were doing confirmation, and like they were like confused about that. And I don't think it was like their, like, I think the movie didn't really present what was going on there. It just kind of, it looked more, is he have a psychological thing, neurotic, like what's going on?
Yeah.
It didn't capture what was very much a real thing in Luther's life, like the Obermann book we mentioned earlier ago, where Luther had a very strong, pervasive sense of the devil in his life. And of course, Obermann would argue that was kind of balanced with his sense of God's presence in his life, too. But I just don't know if the 2003 movie and those scenes where they tried to show that side of Luther, and the 53 version didn't really approach it at all. But the later one, I just didn't feel like it did a good job at it. But that was
me. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Those scenes struck me that same way. I felt like there was something strange about him. It almost like he was possessed, or like he was having some sort of psychotic episode, because he was doing a lot of stammering and throwing himself against the wall. And it's just, I don't know, it's at least not the picture that I've come away with from the wrestlings that Luther has had, which were very real wrestlings. Mm-hmm. I do think they missed a golden opportunity, because, you know, what Luther's really famous for in those episodes with his wrestlings with the devil was saying, you know, be gone, I am baptized. Mm-hmm. And in both of those, they failed to do that. You know, they didn't take him to that point, which I think would have at least had some nice historicity to it.
Well, and one thing, and I don't mean to harp on the 2003 version, but it did seem more, you could tell it was made in a, it just seemed less religious. I don't know, is that the right term? It did, some people, like some critics of an analyst of the movie, and they weren't saying this in a good or bad way, they were saying like Fiennes kind of played like a, I think someone went as far as to say Fiennes played like a Marxist Luther, in the sense of like, it was definitely about like, there's the struggle between the I don't want to say class struggle, but kind of the opposition of have and have nots and ruling oppressors, and the oppressed was definitely, there was more of that accent to the way the Luther and his cause there. I mean, obviously they're fair with showing him how he thought the peasants went too far, but but also, well, we can get into that later, because it kind of like was more of a secularized, it was a little bit more secularized to me, the 2003 version. And I get it, like the one made in the 50s was a different time, and there was much more, a lot more Christian audiences, I guess, then. I don't know. What do y'all think of that?
I would say, go ahead, Kyle.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
So I would say first, I actually agree with both of y'all's critique about the sort of fighting with the devil in the cell in the 2003 movie. I think some of that could be consonant with what Luther would refer to as Anfechtung, that he would experience in his life. And, you know, so it kind of transported me out of the movie a little bit, because you're right. I mean, it looks more like a mental health crisis than it does a legitimate, like, wrestling with the devil.
Yeah.
But where I would say that I thought that, you know, I thought both movies had a very strong Christian influence, as you would hope. Mm-hmm. But where I thought the 2003 movie presented Luther at his most visceral and perhaps even most faithful is the scene where von Staupitz comes into the cell after Luther's had an episode, and Luther asks that, you know,
great question. How can I find a gracious God? I think he said, how can I find a merciful God? And von Staupitz says to him, he takes off his crucifix and hands it to him and says, basically, you find him in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's an actual, I'm pretty sure that's an actual interaction that Luther had with von Staupitz. And that is something that I think was beautifully well done. And that's what sucked me right back in after the mental health episode type thing. But I can see where, so like another great example of where the possible analogy with Marx could come in was when Luther was teaching and was cracking jokes about, you know, how 18 of the 12 disciples were buried in Spain and there were enough nails that crucified Jesus to shoe all of the horses in Saxony.
Yeah.
Really just poking fun at Roman mythology. I mean, to be completely honest,
the cult of relics. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The cult of relics. I guess it's not necessarily fair to call it Roman mythology, but there is a mythological piece to it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
With the relics,
I just didn't want people to start thinking about Hercules. I'm just kidding.
Right. Fair point. I mean, words matter. So that's helpful. But so I can see where, you know, the sort of deconstruction of Rome's cult of relics and Rome's belief in things like the treasury of merit might be something that you could sort of create an analog between that and Marx. But that's also quintessential Luther. I mean, that is exactly what Luther was doing.
So, for sure. You know what I think it is? I think it was a tiny detail that sort of lent it in that direction of seeming like a little bit more of a Marxist Luther. And the tiny detail was in the preaching and the way that he preached and taught. So in the 1950s movie, they had Luther in the pulpit, which as far as I understand, Luther always stayed in the pulpit. But in the 2003 one, they have him down in the congregation, like a modern day, you know, sort of evangelical, non-denominationalist type church where, you know, somebody comes out and just sort of freely wanders in the congregation.
Right.
And then he did the same thing with teaching. And I imagine, I no historical backing for this, I'm taking a shot here, but I would imagine that probably the tendency at the time was to stay a little bit more behind the lectern, maybe do a little bit of pacing side to side, but not necessarily come out. And I think when he was coming out and interacting with people, that to me gave me that feeling of like a more Marxist populist Luther.
Yeah, or that, or just like the hip, cool, pastor.
Right? Yeah.
Not a stuffy stuff, not like those stuffy other clergy. This is the Reformation. This is a new thing.
It is literally It is literally impossible to be the hip, cool pastor with as horrible a tonsure as Luther had, right?
Right.
I mean, there's nothing hip or cool about that. That just looked ridiculous.
No.
But
the Lord is giving me a natural tonsure.
There you go.
Ultimately, I think McGinnis and Fiennes both did very different but good efforts at portraying the reformer. I don't really have many more quibbles with it. I overall enjoyed it. I first watched the 2003 film I was in seminary, and I remember they had it in the seminary library, and I remember checking it out one day, and I watched it in my dorm, and was surprised. I will say I thought it was surprisingly good because I hadn't seen it before, and I know religious movies in general can be hit or miss, and so I really liked it. And I saw the 53 version. I think it was on like Netflix in like 2011. And I was like in, this is what I remember watching it in the apartment I lived in at the time, at that point in my life. And this is before this, so it's interesting. This is before I, you know, became so interested in Luther, and I mean, way before I started this podcast about the Reformation. this is like, I was in middle of college. I was very involved in the Episcopal Church, local Episcopal Church where I was in my hometown, and was starting to think about going to seminary. That was it. This was before I had my own tower moment of reading Luther for intimately for the first time beyond small catechism or anything. But even then, when I watched that movie, I was like, wow, I was really moved by it. The 53 version. So, and I've watched each of them kind of since. Ultimately, I guess I side with the 53 version. I like more. I actually rated it. Any of you go on Letterboxd, which is an app for movies?
No,
it's like an app. It's like a social media app. I like follow like three people on there, and I have a couple of my friends that follow, but you go on there, you can rate movies. It's kind of like if you had a Rotten Tomatoes account. And anyways, I gave 53 Luther 4.5 out of 5 stars, and I gave 2003 Luther 3.5 out of 5 stars, both meaning good, but
3.5 out of 5 stars is terrible, Drew.
That's actually not terrible. There's lots of good movies that I would
put. That's a failing grade, Drew.
That's actually not a failing grade. That would be 2.5 or below.
In my book, it's a failing grade.
C's get degrees.
Well, yeah.
But yeah. But in overall, and I think the reason, I just think, yeah, that historical and theological detail is good. And I really do think the 2003 one, the indulgence controversy was the only time it really touched on theology, and it's hard. Again, can you really do movies about, not only about theologians, but can you do movies where you tackle theology? You have to be really creative about how you approach and go about that. So I recognize, you know, it's how, you know, overall I still think 2003 version was a good movie. They're both good in their own right for different reasons.
I think credit has to go to Alfred Molina, Dr. Octopus, for his portrayal of John Tetzel. I thought that he did a pretty good job. I mean, like, there
was that him?
That was him.
Yeah, that was Doc Ock.
I thought he did a pretty good job overall with that. And of course, he, you know, accurately quoted I can't get it now.
Every time of the coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs.
Right. Yes, I couldn't get the word rings. I had everything. I'm thinking, what was the word? Yeah, that was.
Yeah. Watch this one, Drew. That's Alfred Molina, who played Doc Ock in the worst of the Spider-Man movies.
Oh no! Let's not go down.
Spider-Man 3 was actually.
Yes, Spider-Man 3 was.
That's like one of the worst movies I've ever seen. I mean, it's bad.
I mean,
I wouldn't go that far, but out of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Mans, that was definitely.
Tobey Maguire was a geriatric Spider-Man trying to play a high schooler. But anyways,
not going to say anything. We're going to go off.
Well, speaking of 2003 Luther, that was actually the last movie for the British actor. I always mispronounce his name. I think it was Sir Peter Ustinov. He'd been in a lot of, check him out sometime. He's been in all kinds of, Spartacus, Death on the Nile. He'd been in all kinds of movies for decades.
He played Electric Frederick.
Yep, he played Electric Fred, and he actually stole the show. I think that was the best portrayal, personally speaking. When I went over the 2003 movie, the cast list, someone, Lars, I don't remember his last name, played Melanchthon. I'm drawing a blank. I don't remember Melanchthon at all in 2003 version. Where did he show up?
He showed up only once.
Okay, because I like totally didn't even remember him in that.
It was when Karlstadt was already starting to basically foment dissent in Wittenberg.
And then he and Melanchthon were walking down the stairs, and then Karlstadt, you know, basically threatened him. It was like, get on board or you're going to be killed with the rest of them, kind of thing.
Yeah, and then he did show up two more times with the final scene where he comes running down to tell Luther and Katie von Bora that the Augsburg Confession, the Emperor stood up. That was him.
Yeah.
And then he was present with the Augsburg Confession interaction. Yeah.
I thought the 53 version did a really good job with Melanchthon. I mean, I think he was played more of a major part. I think
he did.
It just to be said without debate, it did have more of a major part in the first version versus the latter one. But I think just the way that conciliar type of, what some Lutherans criticize Melanchthon as being too squishy or whatever. He was that conciliar type of diplomatic type of person in the 53 version. And I thought he was the actor did that well.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts about, so one thing, and this, I wonder if you were thinking the same thing, y'all. Both versions and then other versions of film versions of Luther, almost there has been nothing about Luther's kind of mid-career or his later career. And of course, I guess the most dramatic moments are, you know, the start of the Reformation, or, you know, the what happens with, you know, Luther's early life, his nailing the 95 theses, his debates with Eck and Cajetan, him going before the Diet of Worms, him being, you know, kidnapped for his own good and going to Wartburg Castle. And then, and it seems like in every film, most film versions, that's the scope of of the story. That's the scope of the movie. And granted, that is probably the most exciting parts of Luther's life. And then it's interestingly, the two we're comparing, the two main movies that they've done on Luther, it kind of ends there right after Wartburg. They show a glimpse of him as a married person, and then they both flash forward to showing the signing of the Augsburg Confession. But that's it. There's nothing so much about like the whole the Ottoman Turk threat and how Luther dealt with that. I don't know how if you could really even turn that and translate that into film too well, or even anything in his later life, which again, in reading his works from those times, his commentaries are exciting, his table talks are exciting, but there's so again, maybe I can't fault the people who've tried casting Luther on film, because, you know, maybe that the last two decades of his life aren't as exciting, granted, but it's just interesting how no film has really spent much time in Luther as a more mature man.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. I think that I think you could do some later Luther stuff well in a film. Certainly the Marburg Colloquy.
I think would be,
you know, there's definite stuff you could do there. I think
and the Marburg Colloquy for anyone listening, I mean, it's come up on the podcast a lot, but, you know, the great debate between Luther and Zwingli, who was the other chief reformer of the Reformation at the time, coming from Switzerland, they agreed on so many things, but there's such division between him and Luther on the Lord's Supper, and they had a pretty dramatic conference. That would have been, it would have been cool to see enacted, but. But I'm sorry, Kyle, I cut you off. You were saying other examples, you think, or other of later.
Yeah, the other thing I think, like, you could do something around the Schmalkald articles. You know, there's some deep tension, political tension there that Luther's sort of wading into a little bit. I think you were right. You know, there's stuff you could do around the Turks. I do think you could do a scene that effectively would be the table talks. Right. Mm-hmm. You could have him around the table with his guests that lived in his house and show scenes of, you know, later paunchy, unhealthy Luther, you know, with his family. And
the image I have in my head because this is what I've heard it was. It would be like a beer hall. Mm-hmm. They'd be around with steins of foaming beer at the, and they'd just be like talking theology. But the, I don't know. It was like, it'd be like whenever you hang out and get in a fun conversation with anyone. I don't know. It'd be like today in a social setting. In a way, yeah. I mean, I heard it was like a kind of a fun environment, and so that might have been cool to see on film. Maybe they'll do a series. You could do a series on Luther. I don't know.
That would be a good way to go. Yeah.
And I think, you know, to add to the mix, probably my favorite part of Luther's life is the back and forth that he had with Erasmus.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. I think that, and that would be hard to portray, right? Because it's mainly deep theological concerns that both of them had. But like Luther is at his funniest and at his meanest and most visceral in that in the bondage of the will. Go ahead.
There was it's funny you say that, because there was a Yugoslavian movie made about Erasmus and Luther's debate that was an hour long, and I know else about it. It's been done before, but
that's saying something, seeing as Yugoslavia is
Yugoslavia, no yes. And it's it's kind of random.
That's great. I mean, the Reformation did have a significant influence on, you know, the Eastern Bloc. I don't remember what I was reading fairly recently, as Kyle was saying, and I'm sure you can empathize, Drew, when I read stuff, it all ends up melding together.
Yes.
But I was reading something recently about like how Hungary was actually a significant area for the Reformation until it was eventually suppressed, basically. It might have been Calvin for Armchair Theologians. But anyways,
it could also have been in the Dermot McCulloch Reformation book.
That's exactly where it was.
That's the book you sent me a copy of that, James. It's a big popular work on the Reformation done by a great historian. I've never actually read it. Sitting on my shelf though.
It is it is outstanding. I definitely recommend it.
I do too. I second that. Yeah, it's a great book.
So, y'all want to hear about some of these other Luther movies that I've the very first movie made on Martin Luther is from 1911. Wow. Dr. Martinus Luther. It is a German film. It's a lost film. It was 20 minutes long.
Okay.
That was, I think, common for the 1910s. I mean, the first, from what I've gathered, the first full-length movie was D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which was a very controversial movie. That's the movie where the Klansmen are shown in a sympathetic light. And so it.
Right.
That was the first movie that was longer than, you know, I don't even know. I feel like that was a really long movie. So when they said feature length, they started out feature length. Really, in a very long way, but anyways, 1911, Dr. Martinus Luther, it's a lost film. And then, and this is what Bible Film Blog, and I'll put a link. They did a little Luther Movies 101, but they didn't do them all. They touched on the two we just talked about, as well as a couple of the silent films. But this is what they say about that 1911 version, or the person who wrote the article. It says, no known copies remain of this. The earliest film about Luther, which premiered in Berlin in 1911, and it was distributed by Deutsche Bioskop Gesellschaft. It's 18 scenes running to about 20 minutes, emphasized his marriage and family life. Interestingly, the publicity for the film was at pains to stress that the film was strictly objective, entirely free of attacks on members of other faiths, which suggests that Luther's critique of Catholicism might have been somewhat curtailed. I don't know.
No calling of the Pope Antichrist, I would expect.
No.
Probably not in there. I don't think that was in the 2003 or 53 version even.
No.
They're trying to get it. So I found out the 53 version was banned in Quebec, Canada. And Protestant churches watched it in their basement. They smuggled the film in and watched it in the basement. Because Quebec, right. You know. So 1913, the Wittenberg Nightingale. It was later retitled as Martin Luther, A Portrait for the Light of a German People. It was retitled that in the 20s as, you know, that whole idea of German people. I mean, a little bit, it lent itself to Nazism, but, you know, there was that German solidarity. If you know the history of Germany, 20th century, you know, that people really, that was on the consciousness of people. But anyways, this 1913 film is 21 minutes. A guy named Rudolf Essig plays Luther. It was his first film role. He went on to do many films, all in Germany. His last movie was called The Rothschilds, and it was an anti-Semitic film. We're going to see this anti-Semitism, unfortunately, show up a couple more times because some of these early Luther films were German made. And so that's all I could really find on it. And it's not lost, apparently, but I don't know where to watch it. Again, that's the second one, Wittenberg Nightingale. And that's, of course, the English title. Die Wittenberg Nacht. I don't know what it would be in German. Nacht would be in it because that's night. 1923 is the third one ever made. It's called Martin Luther. It's been released on DVD, though, is Martin Luther, His Life and Times. You can get it on Amazon on DVD. It's not streamable anywhere. And it's not on YouTube either. Some of these older films, some of them are public domain. You can get on YouTube. It's not on YouTube. But 1923. From what I've read about it, it's kind of hagiographic. So there's this book that I'm going to share. It's by Esther Wipfler, Wipfler. She's actually a German scholar. And she wrote a book called Martin Luther in Motion Pictures, History of a Metamorphosis. And she, her argument in there, I think it's like a thesis, a doctoral thesis type thing. And it's like theology meets analysis, I guess, film analysis. It's the only thing I've seen from her. So I think it is like her dissertation or something. And you can get a book form of it for $8.99 on Amazon. I haven't ordered it, but I found out about it like 5 days ago and I couldn't have got it on time. There's no electronic version. I know there is an electronic version, but the ebook's like $41, but I read parts of a sample and the parts of the sample I gathered, said this, this 23 film Luther is kind of seen. There's this visual aesthetic parallel between Luther and Jesus. Like the way they portray Luther's birth is similar to like the Bethlehem scene. So I don't know. I don't know if it's like that apparent, like if it's like going, it's not like blasphemous, but it's just kind of showing like Luther in the light of his Lord. I don't know. Maybe that's a good way to put it. It was shot on location, a lot of the scenes. So Wartburg Castle, they shot some of it there, from what I read. It's the guy who played Luther, and that was Carl Wüstenhagen. It's one of eight movies he was in, all German silent films. I guess he was more of a stage actor. It was based on a screenplay, this 23 version, on a guy, the guy who originally wrote the screenplay for this was named Walter Nittakstan. And I'll put that in show notes. He was interesting. He was a pastor in Berlin who actively opposed World War I before it, during it, and after it. There's a biographical article of him in German in a magazine for church history, which I'll put a link in because you can freely access it and read the PDF. But he kind of had an interesting life, but this Berlin pastor who opposed World War I, but he wrote the screenplay for that movie. So any thoughts so far? I'm gonna try to like breeze through the rest of what's that?
Just fascinating that there've been there were so many Luther movies prior to the 1950s one. I mean, even right. A handful seems like a lot.
It does. And again, they're all German made, so I think he was more, and this is kind of first half of the 20th century, Germany's taking, it's becoming more nationalistic. I mean,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. part of it takes the form, you know, the fascism is kind of a manifestation of, you had to have that backdrop in order to, for fascism, national socialism to make sense. But of course there's other things that became national. So there's a tragic, you know, there's that us looking back in hindsight now, it's like, we can't help but notice that. And that's a perfect segue into the next one. The fourth film version. And I've seen this one. This is 1928. It's a movie just called Luther. It's the most known and most seen of the silent films. And it's the last one. Because actually, they were actually doing sound by 1927, but it was definitely was the most I think like a real movie of any of the four silent. Not that I've seen the other ones, but it was like, actually was like a wasn't like a B movie. It was like a not top notch, but it was like a real production. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it at the time. There was a copy of it uploaded on YouTube. I'm not aware if that was legal or not, but I did see it that way. I tried to look for it again in prep for this episode, didn't find it. I actually did leave a little review of it on Letterboxd when I rated it. I gave it, I think, 2 or 2.5. It's interesting to watch. I think visually it's eye candy because it reminds me a little bit of, you know, like the old Douglas Fairbanks, Robin Hood, and Zorro, this from the mm-hmm. silent era. And some of those period pieces was really beautiful to watch. It even had some of that German expressionism too, you know. It kind of reminded me of some of those movies. But overall, I just didn't think it was a good movie with that, the visual kind of, I read reviews of it after, because I sensed like a very nationalistic, you know, this movie's for the German folk, you know, the great people of Germany. And it just, that was kind of eerie knowing it was 1928. And by that time, Hitler's active. And, you know, so that was kind of again, that's kind of creeping in the background. But I think it was much more in the foreground in this movie, in this 1928 version. So,
right.
And the guy who played Luther was Eugene Klopfer. It's a O with an umlaut over it, Klopfer. He ended up working for Goebbels later on in the 30s and 40s, and he was actually put on this list of approved actors and artists of Germany who represent the German spirit. It was a list Hitler put together, and well, he probably had Goebbels, and it was put together and he approved it. It was like the Führer's list. So again, another eerie element of it. But Klopfer was he fell out of, you know, that came to haunt him after, very understandably, after the war ended. He you know, with the denazification and everything. And I guess he kind of went to stage acting but died in 1950. So not long after World War II, but yeah, he was definitely was part of the propaganda machine, and it was an actor in a lot of Goebbels, or a lot of the Nazi propaganda movies made in the 40s. Then we have 53, which we talked about. Then we have 1960. The next was not till 1964. It's a movie just called Luther. Australian. I don't know anything about it beyond that. Then a year later, in 1965, you have a movie called Luther. It's British. I don't know anything about it beyond that. In 1966, there's Der arme Mann Luther, which means the poor man Luther. It's German. I don't know anything about it beyond that. You can look it up and they'll show the cast. But I was amazed at just so many of these. Some of these movies and some of the ones I'm about to name off are just so obscure. So in 1968, this is the one, if I'm ever going to watch another Luther, which of course I would, but this is the one I would love to watch. And I cannot find how to watch it anywhere. but it was like a BBC 1968 TV movie. Robert Shaw played Martin Luther.
Huh.
Which, doesn't that sound awesome? Yeah. James, you know Robert Shaw, right?
Nope.
Quint from Jaws.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yes. Right. That's his most famous role, but he's been in all kinds of stuff. He played Martin Luther, and it was based on the John Osborne play, but it was like a filmed adaptation. And okay. I cannot find a thing about this movie other than the basic cast and crew, runtime and year. I can't find if you can get a copy of it where you can, you can't stream it. But Shaw is, like, in my opinion, Shaw is one of the greatest actors of all time. So, and I just, he kind of looks a little bit like Luther. I never would have put the two and two together, but when I saw that. Any of you seen the next one, 1974, with Stacy Keach played Luther? That's probably
no.
After the two main ones we've talked about, this is probably the most, I guess, the third most seen one, maybe. Okay. At the time, I think it was also based on the same play. Yeah, it was based on the same play that the 1960, the Robert Shaw one I just said, that's obscure. But yeah, I did watch this one, 1974. It's called Luther. Stacy Keach plays Luther, and I didn't care for it at all. It was like a, it's kind of boring, and I don't know what else to say about it. But yeah, it's very, you can watch it on YouTube.
On YouTube, okay.
Yeah, it's on YouTube. It's called Luther, 1974. Stacy Keach plays him. Then the next movie was 1976. This was the Yugoslavian movie that I brought up when James was talking about Erasmus and Luther. It's called Disput u Noći, which means the dispute at night. And I might have mispronounced this, Slovakian. I don't, yeah, I can't.
Yugoslavian.
Yeah, but that's not their language, is it?
Is it not? I think know. It's like, I'm displaying my ignorance. Is it Slovak? Okay.
Well, that's Czechoslovakia. They speak Czech and Slovak.
Yeah.
But
I didn't know if there was a dialect that was Yugoslavian. Well, I mean,
Yugoslavia broke up into several different territories in the, what was it, the early 90s, I think, right?
Yeah.
But no, that's a little out of my wheelhouse.
You know, I don't know any of those, Eastern European languages. The next one, 1981, is Frère Martin. That's French for brother, right? Brother, yeah. So Brother Martin. Don't know anything about it. 1980, so they made three movies in 1983. West Germany made a movie called Martin Luther. East Germany made a movie called Martin Luther. And then there was a American/British TV movie, which I watched over the weekend. It's on YouTube. It's called, from 1983, called Martin Luther Heretic. Forget the guy who played Luther, but it was only like 65 minutes or something like that. And it actually was, it was good, but it wasn't like an amazing movie or anything. It was made for TV and at that time. But it showed his, showed kind of his, kind of tried to dive into his psyche a lot. And it did a good job, I guess, at that, his struggles, Luther, you know, the actor who played him. But it was very fast paced. They covered kind of that same, you know, from Luther's, his beginning to voice his questions to the, you know, Reformation being officially established. It was like, they did that in an hour. So it was okay. It wasn't like a bad movie, but, and then again, that was called Martin Luther Heretic. And then we're almost done. We have two more. We'd have three more if we included Joseph Fiennes. But in 1984, there was another East German film called Martin Luther. And so this is the most bizarre one I've come across, perhaps. It's in English, the title is Martin Luther and Thomas Munzer, or The Beginning of Accounting. It is based on, from what I've read, there's a Wikipedia article on the play it's based on Martin Luther and Thomas Munster, or the beginning of accounting. It's about how Luther, if you want to talk about Marxists, this is probably the closest thing to an actual Marxist take on Luther, how Luther is funded by a capitalist and Thomas Munster is like the man for the people, and how Luther was really just a friend sided with the oppressor for crushing the peasants. And East Germany made it so.
I mean, that makes total sense. East Germany would want to,
right,
that being, you know, Soviet and communist.
It was the most bizarre of all the versions that I've, and I have not watched it. And at this point, I didn't even look to see if you could see them, but later on, I might. Then there's the 2003 one, and then I don't know if any of y'all have heard of this. In 2017, this is the last one. It's called Lutheran Eye. It's a movie about Katharina von Bora. So, and it's
I think. I think I remember that coming out.
Yeah, and it's a very modern movie made on, you know, very recent. So that's all. I wasn't even keeping count. I lost count after so many. But that's a lot of Luther movies, and I'm just, I was kind of shocked as you were. Like, I didn't know the extent of how many times Luther's been portrayed on film, but a lot. But you know, I think a lot of them were probably. I think the two main ones we've discussed are the necessary ones, I think, that were done. And the other ones are, you know, this TV production here. They made this play into a film. These early silent films, I mean, some of those are actually very interesting to watch, but it's like, you know, so it's more just people that really have an interest in nerding out on watching Luther movies. It would definitely be of interest to them to go to watch all those. There's a couple of those I definitely want and interested in looking further, but you know, I don't need to see them all. There's a couple I'll probably never be able to see. So
yeah.
All right. Well, cool, guys. I didn't mean for that list to take so long, but it's quite a list. So
yeah, no, that was very interesting. And I'm no awareness of how many Luther movies there were short of the two that we talked about.
Right. Those are the two ones that are definitely would recommend to anyone who's interested in Martin Luther at all, whether on film or whether, I mean, those are both good movies. So
yeah,
even if one's better than the other. So
yeah. Now we just need to like get somebody to do a like chosen style Martin Luther series where you could, you know, flesh out more of his life and fill in.
You want to get in touch with Dallas Jenkins.
Dallas Jenkins, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I like the show. We actually did like a chosen themed Bible study. It was really just kind of watching clips of the movie and discussing it. We did an evening series at our church about it then. I love that show. I don't know if I'd trust them with Luther. I don't know.
I would trust Dallas more than Jerry with Luther.
More than who?
His Dallas father.
Jenkins is the son of Jerry Jenkins of Left fame.
Oh yeah, yeah. they would make Luther look like a Baptist. Or
a premillennial dispensationalist.
Yeah,
that's right.
Luther talking about the rapture and giving your heart to Jesus. Right. that's what it would be. So no drinking beer either.
Right.
So, he had no duels.
Right. Yeah.
Fun to imagine though, Jerry Jenkins Luther show. But no, I think. I mean, Dallas could be. I mean, I think from what I've understood, he's him or the people. Maybe it's the Angel production. There's been other things outside of like the Chosen that have come out that I've heard good things about. Sorry,
they just did someone Abraham recently.
Okay, Jesus Revolution. I heard it was good, but
I haven't seen it. But yeah, I've heard it was good.
Yeah, same. Well, if they did do a Luther series, I think that they need to have Bob Kolb and John Pless be the consultants.
Yes.
That way you'd get an accurate portrayal of Luther.
Definitely. Go. Yeah. And that is a reminder, before we wrap up, listeners, stay tuned for our next episode because Bob Kolb is coming on the show, which we're so excited about. So, yeah. Anyways, Kyle, James, it was awesome as always. Kyle, I'd love to have you on again. And we'll let you know. I mean, it's always a pleasure. It's fun to have you on. So,
thank you. Yeah, it's always fun to be on. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys, take care and happy Reformation Day.
And thank God for Martin Luther.
And thank God for Martin Luther.
Amen. God bless.